Let's pray. Father, when you created us in your image, and you invite us to take advantage of at least one aspect of that image, and that is to get to know this world, but especially you, better as a result. And so we are challenged, especially as we learn about some of these people who didn't necessarily know you and what they were trying to do, and maybe trying to do it in darkness. So help us to be challenged by it as we look at the philosophers, some philosophers, and how they address the issue of knowing. Pray in Christ's name. Amen. Okay, my intent today is to give you 2,500 years of philosophy in 1 hour. And my expectation is not that you will become experts, but that you'll at least be able to have a taste of what kinds of issues is out there and why it should matter. I know some of you don't like philosophy. I know some of you successfully avoided philosophy in college or barely got through between naps or whatever. Okay, I concede that. But when I was teaching at BC, I was very proud of one part of my reputation. That is, I turned a lot of people on to philosophy because I made the argument, I don't care what you do, it's important to know how to think. Even when you have to deal with people who you scratch your head and you say, that's thinking. Anyway, we'll meet some of them today, okay? Now, those of you who are philosophy majors, you're going to maybe argue with the choices I made. Can't be helped. We can't do everybody. You're going to get caricatures. So you're going to grimace at some of the characterizations I made. Can't be helped. We've got to do it that way. Okay? And you may take issue with how I characterize certain people. We've got to just sort of hold our breath. And again, unless you have a really pressing question, hold it, please, because I want to make sure I get through pretty much what I have here, and then we'll open it up, okay? Any of you need handouts? Please. Now, the handouts are, they're tickle notes for me. So you look at the words and you're going to say, what? So that's all I did. So you'll kind of understand how it is I do what I do. Review. Last week, we looked at how the Bible addresses the issue of knowing, at least from a couple places. The prologue to the Gospel of John, John 1, 1 through 18, where we meet the Logos. The Logos being in, having a long history in Greek philosophy is the kind of the principle of intelligibility in the world. But that's not enough, because how do we get that? And John answers that by saying the Logos. God himself created all that is before us, and that's what gives us intelligibility. But more importantly, he came to be part of us, one of us, and it makes all the difference in the world. And we looked at Genesis 1, 2, and 3. So we saw in Genesis 1, God speaking, seeing the result of it, pronouncing it good. You have objective creation as a result. But we can't leave it there. So in Genesis 2, as Adam is invited to look upon the animal kingdom to see if there would be a suitable helpmate for him, he finds none. But part of that process is the naming. Biblically, a name is not simply a label, but in fact speaks of the very nature or essence of something. So he comes to understand for himself what God created. So that's subjective appropriation of what was objectively there. Subjectivity at this point is not a bad thing, okay? Understood. But then sin enters the world. And because of that, as part of the fall, all kinds of things get disrupted. And the very key is to look at just what happened. It wasn't the knowledge of good and evil that was in and of itself bad, but how it was acquired. That Adam and Eve chose to go it their way. Had they just seen that there was an issue, do you choose God or you do not choose God, they would have understood the implications of all that happened. Instead, they did it by jumping into the fire and saying, ouch. Okay? So that has implications as we look at philosophy. And we understand that this is part of the fallenness of what we're about. The way to introduce philosophy, the guy named Socrates, you've all heard of him? He was somebody who was, he was easy to make fun of. Aristophanes, the Greek comedic writer, wrote a whole comedy, The Clouds, making fun of Socrates, making him out to be a flea-bitten know-it-all who really didn't know it all and just wanted to keep his head in the clouds. All right. And a lot of you have that impression of what philosophy is about, even to this day. Socrates spent his time in the Agora in Athens questioning people who thought they knew something. And in the process of questioning them, found out that maybe they didn't know as much as they thought they did. He got to be such a bothersome person that, in fact, they condemned him to death. And his reply was, as he was invited to escape, which was his option, and people wanted him to, he said, the unexamined life is not worth living. If you were banished from Athens, if you were banished from the whole form that he had, questioning, what was there to life for him? I remember we were examining this question in my class at BC, and I always ask all my students randomly, what do you think in your life would be worth dying for? And one young woman thought about it for a minute, and she said, I'm not sure there's anything in my life worth dying for. And as we looked at Socrates a little more, we said, well, what did Socrates die for? He did not die for principle. You do not die for principle. You do not die for your faith. What you die for is you die for yourself identified with whatever it is you claim you're dying for. Do you understand? You're dying for self. Because you know that you cannot live if, in fact, something was taken away from you that you see so identified with self. So as we went through that discussion, I returned to the young woman. And she gave me an answer that I said, I better be careful about this. I said, so what do you think? And she looked at me and she said, you know, because she was the one who said, I don't think there's anything I would find worth dying for. So she said to me, I guess I don't think I'm worth enough to die for. I said, whoa, I better be more careful about this question. But nevertheless, what Socrates presents before us is our quest for knowledge. And he does it in a very radical and maybe a very needling kind of way. And some of us, I think if we met Socrates, would find him quite somebody to avoid. See, because we're very comfortable. We know what we know. Or at least what we think we know. We know what we don't know. The things that the professors talked about in college that you said, uh-uh. But you know that if you really needed an answer, you knew where to go and get it. Go to Wikipedia, okay? But what Socrates made very obvious was there's an even larger realm of things we don't even know we don't know. And unless we have that, we are going to be so full of it ourselves that we think we might get on top of the whole project. We're going to meet a guy later on named Hegel. And what he said was, if you read this particular book, The Phenomenology of the Spirit, you will know what God was thinking and how he did his thing. Hegel didn't remember the lesson from Socrates. Okay. So, we're going to begin the way I began all my classes, first class of the year at BC, Boston College. What is this I'm holding in my hand? Somebody want to answer, please? Quickly?
Chair.
A chair. So far, you've given me a name. So all you've confessed to is nominal knowledge. What is a chair? What?
An object.
Well, okay, but that doesn't say much. What else?
A place to sit.
A place to sit. Okay, that's the answer I was looking for. If I were to sit on this, would it be a chair?
No,
it's a table. So that's not a sufficient answer. When we ask for a definition, we want to be able to define precisely what it is we are seeking to define and not anything else. So something to sit on is not a sufficient answer. Anyone want to expand that?
An object to sit on limited to one person.
An object to sit on limited to one person. Oh, you jumped. because your next answer was supposed to be an object to sit on, designed to be sat upon. See? And I'm now sitting on what you would call
a bench,
not a chair. Okay, but you said something to sit upon designed for one person. When you drove here in your car this morning, what did you sit on?
A seat.
A seat, not a chair. It's designed for one person to sit on. Oh, you still don't have it. Okay, now we could go on, but we're not going to because we don't have time. Okay, so we probably want to add portability to that a little bit. Okay, but think about what we're trying to do, and we're going to stop for a minute and say, okay, we've got an idea of a chair. This particular one has four legs. And if we explore it, we find out that four legs are not necessary to the idea of a chair. But supposing I cut 3 inches off of this, one leg, is it a chair? So some of you are a little hesitant. I cut off 3 inches from another leg. Do you have a chair?
But up against the hill, it works well.
Yeah. You're still fighting that. Cut off another 3 inches of this leg. You sure?
I'm sure.
We got a chair still. I cut off 3 inches from the fourth leg. What do we have? Now we have a very low chair. Okay? Think about what just happened. I take the same chair. We got all the legs together now. I'm going to spray it with red paint. Do I still have a chair? What have you done?
Identified chairness.
What, more broadly speaking, what have you done? More broadly speaking, what have you done? You've taken something which is physically in front of you. You've done certain things to it. And you found out that what you were really looking for was something that doesn't change when we change this. Or when we look at this. Something that is decidedly a chair as well, but it sure looks different. What are you doing? You're saying we need to move away from the physical changeable object to something else, to another plane. You want to be more than a two-year-old. You understand? A two-year-old is very proud to say, this is a chair. Not going to think any more of it, and I hope most of you want to be more than a two-year-old. So we're talking physical, changeable, but we're talking another realm entirely. We're beginning to do philosophy, like it or not. Switch gears. Somebody want to point out a circle to me? It's a nice thing, isn't it? We all know what a circle is.
The character in that sign is a circle.
Okay. Good. and something like this, maybe. Someone want to give me Euclid's definition of a circle? Ah, okay, Jacob.
Would you like a mathematical
definition? Yes. Let's see if you get it right.
The number of points that is all the same distance from a center point. So you have an infinite number of points out, and they're all the same distance from the center point.
A continuous line. You miss one crucial element. It's on a plane. It's not on a plane. You know what a cartographic map looks like. Yeah, okay, so how many of you have seen a circle recently?
Seen a what?
Seen a circle.
Yeah.
Where? Right there. Does that fit the definition? It does not. Every line on it is finite and therefore takes up space and therefore could not be mathematically equidistant from a given point on a plane. Any physical object will have a shape resembling a circle, but will not be a circle. You have never seen a circle in the physical world. I gave you a hint there. The only place you can see a circle is here. You understand that? Okay, now you think you're with me. We're going to go one step further. Triangles. Isosceles triangle, scalene triangle, equilateral triangle, right triangle, okay, 3-4-5 triangle. Pick your triangle. You got a picture of it in your head. I don't care. Pick a triangle. You got one of those triangles in your head. Yes? You can see it clearly. You understand that that's where you can see it. Now do this. Picture a triangle which fits the definition of a triangle, three straight lines, three points, three angles. You don't have to say plane because it defines a plane. Picture a triangle in your head which fits the definition of a triangle but is not one of the triangles that we just named. It's not a specific triangle. You can't do it, but you can understand it. Go to your handout. What have we done? See, the major division basically says we have the visible world, the world of changeable things, particular things, and we have the intelligible world, stuff that's in our head. In the world of physical, changeable things, we have things called opinions and things called actual physical objects as such. Most of us operate on the level of opinion. I'm sorry. Most of us. Some of our most important decisions that we ever make are done on the level of opinion. I remember when Mike Dukakis was running for President of the United States. And I was making the point that whenever any of us are invited to vote, we're voting for the image. What we presented. Whatever the story is put before us. And one young woman raised her hand and she says, "Not me. I babysit for his kids." I said, okay. You know. But nevertheless, why do you buy the stuff you buy? You know, you're persuaded. You think your real world is, in fact, what Plato would call the world of opinion. On day one in my class, I would tell my students, your opinion as opinion is worthless and irrelevant. I don't care. Half of them would leave. Because throughout high school, they were told, oh, we value your opinion so much. You know, it really counts. Not in my class. If we disagree on any point categorically, we must agree that at least one of us is wrong. I was perfectly willing to admit I could be wrong, but at least we couldn't both be right. But But how many times do you meet people where, in fact, they presume you can be right and I can be right? Does God exist? Well, we can both be right. Take one answer or the other. It doesn't work that. You meet people like that, you're wasting your time. You can't talk. Okay? We've done philosophy. Do you understand? It's interesting to know in Plato's line that in his second quadrant, belief, physical sciences, that's where all the science takes place, on the level of what Plato called this physical world that we are saying is the only reality we have. We're going to get to the sciences at the end. And you already met the limitations of mathematics and geometry in the notion of a circle and a triangle. And all of a sudden, bam, you have to jump into another sphere entirely. Plato's world of forms and ideas. Now, form can be very deceptive because when we use the term, we think picture. Don't think picture. Even a perfect picture. Because any picture is going to be specific. Think of it in terms of trying to understand what a chair is without picturing a chair. Just looking at it as something which would define it and you can be able to run with it. I listed Plato as an idealist. And it's very funny because I did a lot of reviewing in terms of some of the terms and the like. People don't like that term for Plato because, and some of you may quibble with this because you've studied philosophy, because Plato, in fact, did not disavow the physical world as such. He just wanted you to be cautious about it. So some people want to call him a dualist instead. But what I would say is Plato just wanted to make sense. He didn't want to push us to the point where all of a sudden we're talking nonsense. In modern philosophy, and we'll find out what modern philosophy in a second, things go so topsy-turvy that even kind of Plato gets pushed off a bit. But note this, people will say just about all of philosophy since the time of Plato and Aristotle, whom we'll meet, is but commentary and fragmentation of what in fact has already been set out for. So Plato is somebody who's worth revisiting. I mentioned pre-Socratics only because they're the ones that kind of threw stuff out there, Parmenides, the world of the ideal, the one, the unchanging, the universal, and Heraclitus, that you can't step in the same stream twice, that only thing that exists really are things that change. But philosophic systems, idealism is one where, in fact, you see that reality, if it exists at all, has got to at least be centered on and start with what you have going on in your mind. Empiricism, Aristotle was Plato's student. Empiricism sort of goes the other way, but Aristotle, again, was sound. He did not reject the idea of the ideal world. He just wanted to get to it a little differently. Nothing is in the mind which is not first in the senses. That's empiricism. Okay, so you start with what you see going on around you. And just to give you an example, one of the most important books on ethics was written by Aristotle. How did he start? He could have said, the Greek idea of a human being is social, rational animal. And from that, things would come. Not Aristotle. He's an empiricist. So he goes and he walks around and he says, what do we see happening? What we see happening is that human beings, Greeks, lived together. And it was necessary that they lived together in order to be able to survive. So he concludes they're naturally social. He also looks at human beings and he says, you know, they like to acquire things purposely with design. So his conclusion eventually from all that is they're rational. But you know, when it comes down to it, they still have to do what a lot of other animals do, all the sorts of things that animals do. So he arrives at a standard Greek definition of a human being, social, rational animal. But he does it through observation of what's going on around him. And then from that, certain things follow. Those are two kinds of approaches. And they're two fundamental approaches. That's why Plato, Aristotle, begin in your head, come back out and try to apply it in particulars, or begin from the particulars going around you and try to make sense of it and integrate it into something in your intellect. Now, there's a problem with idealism, or what pretty much became this doctrine of realism. That is, if something were true in Plato's system, it had to exist. It had to exist. Maybe in a way that's even more substantial than all the stuff around you. That's called realism. But realism had a problem, and that is, this particular chair has a smudge on it, this particular chair does not, and you can go all the way down, you can whack one, and they're like, you start multiplying all these things. Is each of them a form? And it becomes rather burdensome. So people said, wait a minute, let's step away from realism. We're not throwing away the ideal yet, but we're only going to say their names, their concepts that we use to be convenient as we converse and as we operate in the world. So nominalism comes along. So it's a step back, and we're saying, okay, is that how we're going to deal with the world now? And by the way, what's the world today? At best, it's nominalist. What we have is we have the names, concepts, and things for the stuff we need to have. All the science ends up being something of that nature. We're going to give it a little different name later on. But we come to the transition figure. 17th century, a person named René Descartes. All modern philosophy begins with René Descartes. What does Descartes do? He says, you know, there's too much fuzziness. I'm interpreting Descartes. Too much uncertainty, too much ambiguity, too much error. So I'm going to invent a philosophy where there's no uncertainty, where there's no error. I'm going to throw everything out that I cannot be absolutely certain about, that is not absolutely clear and distinct to me. So you look around and you say, okay, what does that include? Well, death and taxes. Okay, death and taxes. It includes your wife or your husband or the chair you're sitting on or this room we're in, all the other people in this room. Are they really there? I doubt it. I'll have to answer to my wife later. So he goes through this exercise of radical doubt. He asks, am I dreaming? Is this a nightmare? Is this some kind of fabrication? Or is this some kind of evil genie, a godlike thing that's sort of planting these thoughts in my head? And he wrestles with that, and he wrestles with that, and he says, I have to doubt this, I have to doubt. So I doubt, I doubt, I doubt, I doubt. Is there anything I cannot doubt? And he says, the thing I cannot doubt is that there's this thing called doubting. So we end up with dubito ergo sum. I doubt, therefore I am. Oh, no, no, no. You heard it the other way. I think, therefore I am. Cogito ergo sum. And from there, he intends to kind of put the world back together. And the entire history from Descartes is trying to wrestle with the question, you have people on both sides, whether in fact he was successful doing that. Because if he was not successful, then he's solipsistic. That means he's stuck in his mind. He has successfully retreated back to what he calls the res cogitans, this thinking thing, but can he get out of it again? Okay, as one of my professors pointed out, the problem with the res cogitans is the res cogitans must be cogitating on something, and you're still left with the problem, what's the something he's thinking about? Where is that coming from? Is that to be doubted as well? I mean, basically, you cannot be conscious of anything unless you're conscious of something. Yes, I know it's getting to be a little foolish. Okay? But what Descartes has done is, remember on last week, we said that it is necessary you have objective creation, Genesis 1, and then in Genesis 2, as Adam is invited to name the animals, so the naming is his process of understanding it for himself, of speaking their names, so he subjectively appropriates what was objectively created. Okay? And a lot of you are suspicious about subjectivity. In terms of Genesis 1 and 2, no issue. But since the fall, yes. And what we're going to see with Descartes is he neatly steps aside from the necessity of being tied to an objective world. Because now it's going to be his notion of certainty that he's going to impose on anything else before he'll allow that he knows it. Do you understand what I just said? He says he will not accept anything unless he can be absolutely certain about it. It is his personal test of what, in fact, is allowed or not allowed. He is not going to be conformed to something that is outside of him, whatever that means. See, up to the time of Descartes, the world was a given, and the task of anybody was, let's understand the world. And you didn't have the notion that your understanding of the world would change the world one way or another, depending on how successful or not you were. But from the time of Descartes, things are reversed. Descartes wants to start with the epistemological question. We all know what that means, right? How we know that we know, how we know what we know. Instead of the ontological question, which is, what exists? What is the nature of that existence? What are things? How are they? What are they? I gave you two words. We already know one of them, epistemology, the issue of knowledge, how we know, and ontology, how things exist, that things exist, and that they can be discovered. Remember, if there's a givenness to the world, then somehow or other what we're doing has to be measured by how successfully we understand the world. But if there's not a givenness to the world, then everything is up to us. Somebody who was more infamous than Descartes is a guy named George Berkeley. Spelled Berkeley, but this is the English pronunciation, George Berkeley. Berkeley is the one who says, if a tree falls in a forest... Okay, Hannah, you tell it. If a tree falls in a forest and no one is there, where's there sound? Or the way we might have characterized it, I remember doing this in class at my humanities course at MIT, was, so you get the idea that when you go to bed at night, the whole world gets rolled up. And then when you're awake, you open the window. It's just as you're awake in the window, it gets rolled up, you know, unrolled in front of you. Do you know the difference? Well, Einstein actually debated that question, and their conclusion was maybe at least in a lot of circumstances, you don't know the difference. Okay, very interesting. But Descartes leaves us a problem. Now, I'm going to mention David Hume only because here we have somebody who's kind of a radical empiricist. Now, what's an empiricist? Someone who wants to start with the stuff that's going on around and then begin to integrate it. But he had grave suspicions about the then. So he says there are impressions and there are ideas. Impressions are things we get directly from our senses. There's no error there. We can quibble with that, but our error comes in with our ideas as we try to tie together and to integrate our impressions. That's the error factor. Okay. Now, you know that impressions aren't necessarily error-free. Okay. Any of you want to test how warm the seat cushion is compared to the metal standard on the seats? Which is colder?
The same temperature.
But what do your senses tell you?
The metal
feels colder, only because actually the metal has a greater rate of heat transfer. Mm-hmm. But your senses don't know that. Okay, so you think it's colder. But if it's been allowed to stay at room temperature, it's the same temperature. Okay. The reason you need to pay attention to Hume was Hume supposedly came up with the classic rebuttal against any idea of miracles. He says, throughout history, we've never had a really sound recorded case of a miracle. Therefore, miracles could not have happened. And I'm asking myself, what did you stay in your system when you made that statement? Anyway, so that's Hume. But a more important figure, a guy in the 19th century, Immanuel Kant. I see Kant as trying to recover from the mess Descartes left us in. Okay. Remember, from the time of Descartes, we have no choice. We've got to start with something that's us. And he doesn't tie it with anything necessarily out there. That's always going to be our problem. What's here? What's out there? So Kant is going to say there are actually two worlds. Phenomenal world, the noumenal world. The phenomenal world is the stuff that we are conscious of, our everyday lives. But what's our problem? We met that with the chair. Our problem is we have to make sense out of the phenomena in one way or another. How can we make sense of the phenomena? Because the chair by itself doesn't give you that. So you know instinctively that you've got to go beyond the phenomena to the noumena. But Kant says you can't get to the noumena. What you've got to presume is that there is a noumena and there are things in there which help you to make sense out of the world. So he says we have das Ding an sich, the thing in itself, the thing which accounts for why we have whatever we're having. But we can't get to it. We just have to presume it's there. Why do you do what you do? Why is there an ought in your life? The ought is, by the way, he concedes is universal in terms of our phenomenal world. Well, he concedes it's actually one of the pointers to requiring, but not knowing, that there's a God. Okay? And that within the noumenal realm, there's a way that reason can help us to understand what is probably there in the noumenal realm behind our feeling of ought. And that is what he calls his categorical imperative. That you're always to act in such a way that the reason for your acting you can state as a universal law. We know it as do unto others as you would have them do unto you, but he says it much more philosophically. But note, he doesn't know that it actually is there. He just says, you got to act as if it's there. This is modern philosophy. This is why a lot of you laugh when you think philosophy. But this is modern philosophy because it sounds like we're getting into stuff that maybe we have no business getting into. I'm just going to leave that for a while, okay? We also have a person named Hegel. I wasn't going to do Hegel to begin with, but I thought we really needed to do Hegel. Because the distinction we want to have with Hegel is, first of all, here's a method. A method is thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And you say, well, what does that have to do with anything? Well, you, as a person, are always doing it. By this, I mean, you have an understanding of yourself. Maybe you could state that understanding. And then you see something which, in fact, is not you. And you say, can that possibly be part of me? In other words, thesis, antithesis, something comes from that. So my thesis, I'm me, 60-some-odd years old, and I think 4-minute mile. And I say, no, that's never going to be me. The synthesis has got to be a lot more like half an hour mile, you know? So you can take that methodology. But the thing I want to emphasize here is Hegel says we shouldn't be so concerned about the nature of something unless it happens to be a piece of rock or something that's inanimate. Rather, we should be concerned about how is it carrying on in time as spirit moving. Okay, so he wrote a whole book on phenomenology of spirit. And again, he said, if you understand this book, you'll understand how God was thinking. German hubris. Okay. But the thing that I think is important and why I decided to bring him back here is not nature, but spirit history. Spirit works itself out in history. Okay. You, again, this is something you do all the time. When you meet somebody for the first time, what do you say to that person about yourself? What's your height? What's your weight? No hair, you know? That's not what you do. What do? You tell them your story. You tell them your story because that's the thing that's important to you. That's who marks who you are. As you grow, you'll find that your story changes. Certain things that were important to you as a 15-year-old, not important anymore. You don't include them. Okay? So your story is constantly changing. And that, in fact, sets up who you think you are. Hegel is the one who gives us national spirit, school spirit, company spirit, that whole idea of something that galvanizes a people together to say, yes, we are. This is how we're united. That's Hegel. We also get Communist Party through Marx from Hegel. But still, that's what's going on there. So Hegel is very much a part of your vocabulary, even though you don't necessarily know it. Okay. Who are you? You tell your story. Some of the most traumatic times in my life were in that kind of situation. I don't know if they do it today, but back in the 60s, when you wanted to meet somebody, they put a dark room in there, put a lot of women in there, a lot of guys in there, and they say, go meet. And you go up to somebody and you say, hi, my name is Harry. And you're willing to follow up your story, but something has to happen first. If she doesn't give you her name back, forget it. She says, you don't count. Talk about trauma, huh? I thought I'd sneak that in there. Any questions right now? Quick questions. So we're going on to this thing called scientism. I call it scientism. People call it scientism. Philosophy of science, or what is purported to be science. And a lot of it comes down to what's called positivism. What is positivism? Remember, we no longer have an objective reality we can reference. We have a series of names, categories, and things that we can throw stuff into. And it matters how we say it, how we put it together, how we posit it. And from how we posit it, whole systems grow and are testable against that. Again, you're very familiar with it, even though you don't do science for most of you anyway. Do you realize that the United States of America is based on what is called a legal positivist system? Legal positivism? Any of you heard that term before? Illustrate. When Clarence Thomas was being examined for the Supreme Court, he had some baggage. The baggage was he was a proponent of what is called natural law. He was told when he came before the senators to be examined, do not defend that notion. You are no longer a natural law specialist because that is not the official position of the United States of America. Natural law may have a standing in Great Britain, but not in the United States. What is the basis for United States law? The Constitution of the United States. That is the document. Everything comes from that. It's a created document. It has a bunch of words. And I was looking down and I said, somebody gave you a bum steer. Because, Clarence Thomas, you could have said, in the 19th century, people found that the United States Constitution was wrong and sought to correct it, even going to war over it. You cannot say that your primary document is wrong. All you can say is, we would like to change it, amend it. Do you understand? That's a positivist system. You put forward something and you say, this is the stuff that we're going to then build everything else on. And science does that as well. Various theories that are out there. And how do you know scientifically that something is correct? You have the right numbers. That's what it boils down to today, isn't it? You have the right numbers. But guess what? A pre-Socratic called Pythagoras, from which we get Pythagorean theorem, said that 2,500 years ago. Everything, the essence of everything is number. Number. Not a terribly creative thing. Some of you heard of the Higgs boson. If you hadn't, don't worry about it. I'm not an expert in it, but I have a few things I want to use it for. Supposedly, the press has characterized it as the God particle because it is what gives existence to all the other stuff they've come up with. That's blasphemous. The Higgs boson, whatever it is, however it functions, does not have one key thing which absolutely has to be of God. It has to have what's called aseity, self-existence. It ain't. How do we know that? Because all our theories, everything that we have right now, goes back to this thing called the Big Bang, right? Well, guess what happens at the Big Bang? Notice nobody talks about, if they're credible at all, no one talks about what happened before the Big Bang, because they can't. What happens when you divide by zero? Everything blows up. That's what happens at the Big Bang. They can talk about what happens just a little bit afterwards, but not at it. So we know Higgs boson is part of that, everything else. So whatever it is, if you don't explain how we got what we got, you haven't explained anything. It's a theoretical unknowable. It's a barrier. This is for science. It's a theoretical unknown, not a practical unknowable. It's a theoretical unknowable. And I have to be careful here because what I don't want to do is I don't want to tie my apologetic to a specific scientific theory. But I'm saying as it stands right now, there's a theoretical unknowable there. Oh, by the way, it also happens on the other side. First of all, one of the few quotes I'm going to have here. A guy named Heisenberg had a critique of the positivist view of science. The positivists have a simple solution. The world must be divided into that which we can say clearly, and the rest which we had better pass over in silence. If you can't say it in a way that's testable, forget it, it doesn't count. But can anyone conceive of a more pointless philosophy, seeing that what we can say clearly amounts to next to nothing? Remember, a positive is coming out of Descartes. If we omitted all that is unclear, we would probably be left with completely uninteresting and trivial tautologies. Heisenberg is the one who comes up with the uncertainty principle, which basically says there's a limit to what you can know about these small elementary particles. And some people would say yes, because when you push a particle to try to define its position, energy, momentum, whatever, direction, then you're necessarily affecting it. Well, that's part of it, but that's not the essential part. Heisenberg says this is theoretically unknowable in terms of the very equations they're working with. So why is all this important? Because science tells you that their object, their goal is find out everything. Everything is, in fact, knowable. Nonsense. These are two theoretically unknowable points. There's no getting around them. It's not practical. It's theoretical unknowability.
Just to sum up, what you're saying is the current dominant theme epistemologically in the modern world, scientism, doesn't really tell us very much, because theoretically it's unknowable. A lot of the things they purport they're going to discover, it's unknowable.
I don't want to take away too much. I mean, obviously they've given us a lot, but the point is there's a kind of a hubris that needs to be addressed. Okay. That science isn't the end-all, be-all.
It's always changing.
Yeah.
As they know more.
Right. The best storytellers now are astronomical physicists and theoretical physicists. They're the best storytellers. They're the best myth makers now.
Yeah.
Okay? They don't understand something, they'll give it another name. Yeah.
Science is built, there's nothing in the current scientific that says, oh, we're going to stop here. That doesn't enter any scientist's mind. We're just going to keep.
But just give us enough time, we'll figure it out. That's
yeah.
Adam. Right? And that's what I think right here is addressing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I guess I'm spending some time here because a lot of times we get threatened by that and we can't challenge it. I'm saying no. Scientists know a lot of stuff we don't know. I'm not going to put my head in the sand that way. But I am saying when they start pushing up against things theological, I say, wait a minute. And you yourself have the limitations that is right in front of you that, in fact, you have to acknowledge. There's a guy named Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N, I think he's in your notes, who wrote The Copernican Revolution. You might want to read that. Okay. Basically, what he argues for is that for any given time in science, any given particular historical period, you have a group of scientists who are invested in a theory of some sort. Okay. Certainly, up to the time of Copernicus, everyone was on board the Ptolemaic view of the heavens, yes? So Copernicus comes along and he says, wait a minute, we're not talking geocentricity, we're talking heliocentricity. The sun is the center, right? And then supposedly the whole world jumps on. Not so. Kuhn would argue that the generation of the Ptolemies had to die off before the new guys came in. And by the way, did the Copernican theory take over because it was more accurate? No. Ptolemy had a lot of history there, and they were very precise in terms of how they calculated the movements of planets and stuff. Was it simpler? You know, the Ptolemaic theory had circles, and it circles on circles on circles, so you had these epicentric circles going around. No. Copernicus was a little simpler, but he had circular orbits. Guess what? That doesn't solve the motion problem. Not until Kepler comes along with elliptical. So when you look at the Wikipedia article I did on Copernican Revolution, it's a lie. It's a lie. You're going to see there, here's Copernicus, and there are nice little circles around the sun. And isn't that neat? And they're going to have the Earth and all these wiggly-woggly things around the Earth. and saying, that's a comparison. That's a lie. Don't believe everything you read in Wikipedia. Okay? Classic example, the discovery of oxygen by a guy named Priestley. What was the problem there? Priestley didn't know he discovered oxygen. He was married to phlogiston theory. So he was able to isolate dephlogisticated air. He didn't know he had oxygen. It took a guy named Lavoisier to come along and say, in fact, that's something that fits the other theory better, and let's call that oxygen, and that's what we have today. So Priestley discovered, well, not quite, because he didn't understand what he had, because he was married to a whole scientific theory. So another thing, science is purely objective? Wrong. They all have things they're trying to defend to guard their turf. And those of you who are involved in engineering and science now know that to be the case. You have safeguards about stuff that's going to challenge your pet positions. Right reasoning, that's what we're about. Reasoning that's not going to be infected by the stuff of the fall. Remember, there's nothing wrong with knowledge. There's nothing wrong with truth. It's just that we misappropriate it, we misuse it, and we play it to our advantage. I'm going to ask you a very funny question. And all of you say, oh, I know the answer to that. Did Adam have a belly button? Did he have a belly button? That's a serious question. It sounds funny, but it's a serious question. Why? What does the belly button do or not do?
It's your mother.
So what? So what are we talking about?
Adam didn't have a mother or birthday.
Okay, so therefore he could not have had a belly button? Is that what you're saying?
He didn't need one.
He didn't need one. He might have had one, but he didn't need one. The point is this. When Adam, if he thought necessary, in the garden to cut a tree down, were there any rings in that tree? When Adam looked up in the sky, were there any stars in the sky? You see, when we think creation, what we don't think about is that a lot of the physical clocks were not at zero at creation. He looks up in the sky, and that sky is at least 3.5 years old. That's only for one star. Understood? No, he looks up in the sky and he sees the stars. We're not told that. I'm conjecturing it, obviously. But the point I'm trying to make is, if he had a belly button, his generation would be T plus one, as far as what was on him. We should not object to that. In fact, if you looked at Adam, you'd say, Adam, you're at least 18 years old, approximately. So his time was not zero either. Do you understand? We need to ask the right kinds of questions. In the 19th century, when people were objecting to Darwin, they made the mistake, the theologians made the mistake by equating kind, in Genesis 1, with species. And so all of a sudden, their battle was lost because they picked the wrong thing. Okay? Just some stuff to think about. And I'm going to shift to the end. What's missing here? It's not simply the intellect, but in fact, what drives us to include the stuff we know and exclude the stuff we don't know. And that's the will. We do a lot of filtering. I remember I had a good friend at BC who was a diocesan priest up from New Jersey. He actually used the course so he could get out of his duties in New Jersey. But we were talking at lunchtime, and he said, you know, I learned a very important lesson today. He worked in a home for people that had Down syndrome. And so he would walk around with two or three of them at a time, walk around Cambridge, and, you know, fresh air and the light. And as they were walking down the street, he had two women with him, and he was walking past somebody who was sitting on the sidewalk. We've done that. And the two women with him stopped, went down to the guy's level, and started talking to him. And my friend Joe said, he learned something, because he did not see them until they did what they did. They didn't register. Okay? Because that's the way we function. We kind of will ourselves in a certain direction, and that's how we want to go, and we don't invite a lot of stuff in. Deuteronomy 6:4, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Why do I say it here? Because from the Greek understanding of knowing, it lends itself to the scientific model. Dispassionate, at a distance, right? You can stand off from it. You don't necessarily have to be involved. Although I think Socrates would take issue with that. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Those of you who are parents, or those of you who are children, both, okay? When your child does not want to do what you're asking them to do, what do? They conveniently not hear you. Isn't that true? Because what hearing does, hearing comes inside. Hearing demands a response. You're on the line. Hear, O Israel. Get it inside of you. So that whatever it is you do and say, it has to be with the understanding God is one. God is our God. And we're called to be because of that in a very different way. I said last week, sin is absurd. It has no part of reason. Reason isn't necessarily for it or against it. It's just something we might use to make ourselves excuse for something we do. Knowledge, same way. It's there. If it's true, if it's not been repackaged in such a way that it's not true, if it's true, it's of God. Most of the time, we have it repackaged, so it's very hard to tell. So what Deuteronomy 6:4 does is it invites us to include the will, what is called voluntarism, not just intellectualism, voluntarism. And our will has a lot to do with our knowing, much more than we think. An intellectualist approach to God is to bring God in a way that God can be examined. And you want to do that. You want to get to know God better. A voluntarist approach to God is to say, I love you, I love you, I love you, to run to the beloved. There are two things, but probably not so different if we understand that they work together. And that's why people like Augustine, whom we haven't talked about, who's very important in Christian theology and Christian thinking, is so important. That somehow or other we need to be energized by our love for God, and our knowing needs to be energized by that. You ought to know that Augustine was probably the most prolific writer in the early centuries, 5th century. Volumes. Some of the most profound stuff. And what motivated him was his love for God. Let's pray. Father, we can use the whole idea of knowing as a way to sidestep you, to avoid you. And that's clearly what's going on with a lot of these so-called thinkers. And yet, Lord, you've put us into this world where we are invited to use all our faculties, including our mind, that we might grow to understand you and love you even more, and to understand and be about the business you set us to. And we can only do that, Lord, with a mind set on you and an ability to see the world even as you would have us see it. Now challenge us. Protect us. Protect our leaders. Protect Eric and Luke. Protect our church. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.